I can't tell you what a pleasure this is, George, because I guess everybody who enjoys music loves the shearing sound. I don't think I've ever heard anybody who doesn't appreciate your music. That must be extremely flattering to you.
Well, Arnold, it really is. And, you know, every time I hear somebody say, "I can't tell you how much," I'm taken back immediately to my first vibraphonist, Marjorie Himes, who had a marvelous sense of humor. And before I knew the difference between the American and the English sense of humor, Marjorie used to take me off the stand in 1949. And somebody came over to her one day and she said, "Oh, Miss Himes, I can't tell you how much I enjoy your music." And Marjorie turned to them in a very irate voice and said, "Well, send someone over who can." And I wanted the earth to swallow me up because I hadn't been here that long and I was still a little wet behind the ears, you know.
Let's start right back at the beginning, George, if we can. You were born, I understand, August 13th of 1919 in the Battersea District of London.
That's right. I see you do your homework.
Right, yes, there. One of eight children.
Well, actually, this is an error. It's nine children.
I didn't do my homework well enough.
Yes, you did. You just read the wrong copy. But I'm not sure that the right one exists, so.
You were born sightless, too, George.
Yes, that's right. You know, I'm glad you put it that way because I was on a show once and somebody said to me, "George, tell me, have you been blind all your life?" And I said, "No, not yet." You know, I'm one for semantics.
Have you ever felt this as a terrible handicap as far as music is concerned? Of course, not being able to read music must have made it difficult, but do you feel that perhaps you have a keener ear because of the lack of sight?
Oh, there are some marvelous sighted pianists with very keen ears. I think that when we do have an extra sense of concentration by being blessed with the necessary genes or so on, I think it is enhanced by blindness and by lack of distractive elements, you know. Mm-hmm. I think that we can concentrate because of this. There's a great library of Braille music to read. Mm-hmm. It still has to be memorized, and it's a tedious process. I've never felt it a great handicap. I felt that there are times when it was a nuisance. I mean, there have been lean times in my life when I thought that perhaps I had the ability to be a studio musician without the ability to read sighted music, which is an absolute prime requisite for studio music. Mm-hmm. However, I had to wear those times down, and in so doing, instead of being a hack studio musician, I come out to be the leader of my own group. So it's a nuisance. It's not a handicap. Mm-hmm.
What led you to play the piano, and how old were you?
I was three when I started playing piano.
Is that right?
My family tell me that I used to listen to things on the old crystal set and then go over to the piano and kind of just pick them out.
What tremendous training that was. What kind of a formal musical education did you have?
I studied at two blind schools. I've had no university education whatsoever. And interestingly enough, the blind teacher who taught me at both schools was still teaching at the same school when I went back to take the group back on a concert tour in 1962. And I said to him, "Mr. Newell, when I was 16, you told my parents that further study of classical music would be a waste of time, and it was obvious that I was to become a jazz musician. As you know, since then, I have restudied Braille music, incorporated classical music into my livelihood, and what do you have to say about this advice today?" He said, "George," he said, "if I had to give the advice today, I would give exactly the same advice. Because," he said, "after all, the main source of your livelihood is still in jazz. And jazz is primarily contingent on creativity and being able to play by ear and being able to play with the use of one's musical imagination. Therefore, the mere fact that you have studied classical music and used it as part of your livelihood is more power to you. He said, but it's not still the main source of your livelihood. So my advice would be the same.
Uh-huh. What was your first professional experience?
If you can call it a professional experience, Arnold, I started playing in an English pub for $5, the equivalent of $5 a week, and an extra and a box on the piano for any extra gratuities that customers care to donate. I got so tired of playing Melancholy Baby, I can't tell you.
You still won't play it again to this day.
Oh,
probably.
Well, I will, but I mean, I usually turn my face the other way, and I play it with crossed hands and the most serious look on my face possible, and you usually find 10 people in a room of 300 who are breaking up, and the other 290 think they've gone out of their minds, and these 10 people realize that I'm putting everybody else on.
You joined a band, I happened to find in one of the books as I was doing some research here, in the late 30s, called Charlie Bampton's All Blind Band.
Claude Bampton.
Claude Bampton.
And it was an all blind band. It was a band of some 15 blind musicians who were taught to be chair caners and basket makers and so on. Our theme song was I'll See You in My Dreams. And the way we got the beat was Claude, who was the only fully sighted member of the band, would wave a huge baton around in the air. And so the commencement of the program would be whoosh, 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 ba-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee. Well, one night we were ready to play a theatrical engagement. And of course, the curtain is always down while people are setting up, you know. And the stage manager said, okay, fellas, you ready? One guy said, no, wait a minute. Lost my eye. His glass eye had fallen out and rolled across the stage, and his 15 blind guys down on the floor looking for this glass eye. They found it, gave it to him, he put it in, and the show went on. How they didn't massacre this thing under their feet, I'll never know.
Isn't that something? What
we were
inspiring.
Playing Lunsford arrangements and Ellington arrangements,
right?
And all from Braille music, you know, of course.
Gee, that's great. That's terribly inspiring, I think, and you probably have heard from many other sightless people throughout your career, and I'm sure you've been an inspiration to many of them.
Well, you know, I feel very fortunate in that blindness generally, you know, the blind group is, so to speak, an underprivileged group. It is a group subject to prejudice born of ignorance, the same as any other prejudice is. And we have to live this down by surviving in spite of. And I feel very fortunate in being one of the people who have been allowed to, permitted to, and encouraged to, you know, exist regardless of this prejudice. Because, you know, you go into a club before anyone knows who you are, and you want to get a job, say, as an intermission pianist in that club. If the club owner is thinking about hiring a scale musician, and he has a choice between, and I mean, he's got a lot of businessmen going in there, spend a lot of money, and he has a choice between hiring a sighted girl or a blind guy. I mean, let's face it, Arnold, where is he going?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the sighted girl's going to attract more businessmen. And because she's a sighted girl, he feels that, the club owner feels that she is not as subject or prone to accident on his establishment. And she is not going to be the threat to his insurance. Mm-hmm. You know, these are very realistic economic things which have to be thought of. And so, again, you see, we have a prejudice born of ignorance. Actually, a blind person gets into far fewer accidents than a sighted person because he's that much more careful. I mean, for instance, when I make coffee and I pour it, I pour the coffee over the sink. Mm-hmm. And so I'm never going to stain or damage a table.
I, for one, don't have enough sense to do that.
Well, you don't need to, you know, because you feel that your vision will take care of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that my careful aim of a cup will take care of it, but I don't take the chance.
When you made your first trip to the United States, George, in all modesty, you probably won't want to answer the question this way. Was your name already a household name?
No.
Was it well known?
No. I came over here with $2,000 in my pocket and a family and good luck, Charlie. Mm-hmm. I came over on a vacation in 46. I went back, sold up my home, came back on immigration in 47. The quintet did not start until early 49, mm-hmm. when the whole group was available for a few hundred dollars a week, which was the scale for yes. the place that we happened to be playing. Because our business, like any other business, is a question of supply and demand, personal identification, maintenance of that identification, establishment of a good sense of public relations, salesmanship, and so on and so forth. We would also do well to remember that our business is not a business of necessity. And so be careful of being too, egotistical about what you have. Because what you have may be great for today. We've been very fortunate. The group started in 49. We've just celebrated our 23rd anniversary. I make a joke with the audience and say, of course, as you can see, all the original members are still with us, and they see those young faces up there, you know. And sometimes they don't even think, and they applaud that. And I say, yes, it died in Indianapolis too, you know.
How did you come up with the shearing sound? It's so distinctive. I don't think anybody had done it before you.
It's quite accidental. Actually, I had a rhythm section. John Levy on bass, Denzel Best on drums. John Levy went on to manage, well, we actually put John Levy in the management business. Mm-hmm. He went on to manage Nancy Wilson, Roberta Flack, Les McCann, and
did he have any big stars too?
So Buddy DeFranco was negotiating with Capitol Records. We were negotiating with MGM, and our wives managed our individual careers. So, you know, this spells immediate separation, mm-hmm. you know, from business wise. Ironically enough, later on, we were to negotiate with Capitol and Buddy with MGM. But, you know, the Twains didn't ever meet. We've always maintained a very good friendship. But Leonard Feather, the jazz critic, and I put our heads together and said, now, we want to maintain this very nice, quiet, subdued rhythm section. What can we do? Leonard said, well, you heard Marjorie Himes with her trio. You heard Chuck Wayne with his. Let's get those two nice quiet instruments together with your rhythm section and see what happens. The sound was accidentally born at rehearsal. The locked hand style, which people erroneously credit me with inventing. Actually, I think I can take some kind of credit for bringing it before the average public, in that I used it to play Roses of Picardy instead of the blues. But I did not invent it. The locked hand style
was
first played by Milt Buckner when he played with Lionel Hampton in the late, or the, in the early to mid 40s. If you were to break our sound down, it would be Milt Buckner with the vibes playing the melody and the guitar playing the melody an octave below. Or, if you will, a style which perhaps would be even more readily identifiable or easier to relate to, the Glenn Miller sound, where he has a clarinet on top. Mm-hmm. The clarinet part would be played by the vibes. And he has four saxophones, the bottom saxophone played by guitar, and all five saxophone parts played by the piano, mm-hmm. Plus a well-ordered and subdued rhythm section with a written bass line so that the roots are always taken care of and so on and so forth. If I go any further with it, I'll become kind of technical and then do that.
When you first heard it, did you realize that there was a magic sound to it?
No.
Is that right?
No. We recorded an album for Discovery, and then we recorded four sides for MGM. We never recorded an album as such for MGM. Well, we did, I think, what did we do? Four, eight sides for Discovery, not an album. We did four, eight sides for Discovery. as we got four tunes ready, we recorded them. And later on, when LPs became fashionable, MGM concocted their stock into albums. And they paced them and did everything. And then we went with Capitol in 55. And that's when we started to really do albums. This is when the A&R man and I would sit down and think up a theme for an album. Velvet Carpet. So we're not going to ever have in Velvet Carpet, we're not going to have anything brassy and anything very extraneous. We did things like Autumn Leaves, Foggy Day, Dancing on the Ceiling, with a small body of strings and the quintet.
It was September in the Rain, wasn't it, in 1949, that was really kind of the key to the kingdom.
900,000 copies of September in the Rain as a single record.
It's not bad.
We didn't mind it at all.
George, as you went on with your recordings, I know that a name of a gentleman who is from this area, from New Britain, a fellow by the name of Conrad Gazzo, recorded with you and with just about anybody who's anybody, everybody who's anybody in the music business.
That's true, Arnold. He was really one of the top lead trumpet players of any time. He was a fantastic player. And we did a record with him. I think he did an album called Burnished Brass.
Yes, he did.
Us. And he really was a fine trumpet player. I played a benefit for him when he died, a benefit for his family.
He was a fantastic...
Marvelous man. I met him with the Sam Donoghue Band in England.
Mm-hmm. As you listen to other pianists now, are there any that you admire above the others?
Yes. I love Bill Evans, of course. Hank Jones, Oscar Peterson. Let's see. There's a guy named Monty Alexander who's playing marvelous piano today. My influences, of course, my early influences were Teddy Wilson, Art Tatum, Fats Waller, and the Boogie School, you know, Albert Ammons, Pete Johnson, Meat Lux Lewis, Bob Zirke. These were my influences, but primarily Tatum.
Did you ever hear of a pianist, I hope I pronounced it right, Frank Horrex, with the Ted Heath Band?
Yes. I've always felt... And, you know, we'll probably get half a dozen irate British phone calls, but I will have long since left the studio, so it doesn't matter. I've often felt that, until fairly recently, the English jazz musician was a copy of the American. There isn't such a thing as an English jazz style. You know, we've got a lot of bands over here who, perhaps if they couldn't be mistaken for Ted Heath, I don't know whether Ted Heath could be picked out as an individual. And when I came over here with the knowledge that I was known as the British Art Tatum, the British Teddy Wilson, the British... I mean, jazz is born here. You know, I mean, polished jazz. The elements that go into making up jazz and its embryonic stages were born in a number of places. In Africa, with the Scotch reels. But jazz is one of the few American art forms that we have. So how can any originality for it be claimed in England?
Yeah.
See, I didn't say anything bad about Frank Horrex, did I?
Not at all. What is your favorite type of music? When you have a rare evening off and you can sit at home and listen to the record player yourself, what kind of music would you listen to?
I love Bach. I love Mozart. I love the Impressionist school, Ravel, Debussy. Mm-hmm. Delius. I think Frederick Delius is so underplayed over here. It's pathetic. I love Delius. One of the English original approaches to me is that school, Frederick Delius, and his offshoot in the pop field, the standard good music field, Robert Farnon. I listen to Bob Farnon all the time. Now that is something which is originally English because of its very pastoral nature. You know, we English are very placid people. You know, I don't know why I say we English. I became naturalized in 1956. Incidentally, that was a very easy examination. The examiner said, who's the president? I said, James C. Petrillo, you know, in right away.
I interviewed Stan Kenton not too long ago, George, and he told me that he found that his records were simply not available in the record stores anymore. And yet
I have the same problem.
Yes, that's right.
Exactly,
and it led to the
same
conclusion. He said that every time he played personal engagements, people would say, where can I buy these records? So finally he decided to heck with it, and he put out he bought the masters, I guess, and put out his own records on his own creative artist label. And now, lo and behold, George Shearing has done likewise.
Well, Arnold Dean, you are a very nice man, because I wanted to inform your listeners about this development in us, because through our 23 years of career, we have racked up some 50 records, 40 of which are on Capitol. I doubt whether you'd find more than 3 in the stores today. You know, we're kind of a victim of the same thing that any other catalog attraction, by catalog attraction, I mean the guy who, through steady sales, will rack up 50,000 sales, rather than a group like the Beatles, who will come overnight and sell 500,000. So the rack jobber, the one-stop operation, and the guy who has small facilities for extensive inventory is better with an artist who sells 200,000 than trying to handle 10 artists, each of whom sell 20,000. So where does it leave the standard artist? It leaves him with 2 ways to go. Either he can go with a small company who will dedicate their lives to him, but their lives are not extensive enough. That's why they are a small company. And they don't put out any front money, so there's no guarantee that they're going to do that much work. Or he can form his own company, whereby if promotion is lacking, or if it is on a small scale, it is only on as small a scale as his resources need it to be. And he is dedicated to the proposition of raising that scale at the earliest possible moment. This is why we have the creative world of Stan Kenton, and this is why we have our label, Sheba, S-H-E-B-A, which is a concoction of my name, the first 3 letters of my name, and the first 2 letters of my wife's maiden name, Bays. And in case your listeners ask any awkward questions, I'm the king of Sheba. So, you know, I don't want any.
No confusion.
Since the 1st of May last year, we had launched this label at the same time that we celebrated our 30th wedding anniversary. We also launched Sheba Records. We have 4 albums out at this present time. We have a solo album in which I deal with a number of tunes in an impressionistic way, or in a Baroque manner, mm-hmm. or just showing some Tatum and Teddy Wilson inspiration. We have a trio album in which I utilize the rhythm section to help in a free swinging idea of tunes like When Johnny Comes Marching Home, Happy Talk, and stuff like that. We have a quartet album, which is kind of more the same, except in a few instances we have a slight rock feel. A very good blind friend of mine, Don Heitler, on organ. Then we have a trio album with the exciting vocal sounds of Joe Williams. We did a very relaxed and very informal type of album, the kind of thing we would do if we were kind of sitting around in your living room. That's called The Heart and Soul of Joe Williams, and it's so called because every tune on the album has either heart and or soul in the title. And is this the time to tell the listeners where these things are available?
You be my guest. Please do.
Stan and I are thinking about dealing with a few isolated dealers here and there. And Stan is 2 years ahead of me, so he's probably gotten to it already. But our largest volume of business is done through mail order. And our address, from which the Stan Kenton address is available, I don't happen to know it offhand, but my office has it. Our address is Sheba, S-H-E-B-A, Sheba Records, Box 2120, North Hollywood, California, 91602. And now back to Arnold.
Will you be re-releasing some of your old favorites on this label, George?
We are at the present time in the process of discussing this very thing with Capitol and with MGM. You can imagine that the first offer tendered is not necessarily the one. For instance, when we have 40 albums for Capitol, a five-year lease on these albums isn't going to do me much good, because I've got to think of new product, and I've got to think of how many of the old albums I can re-release. If we were to re-release three albums a year for 5 years, you know, we would get to some of the catalog, a majority of the catalog. But no, we would get, what, 15 albums, right? Mm-hmm. Well, that's not allowing for any new product. So, obviously, the five-year agreement is not the one to go for. And this is why, when I say it's in negotiation, kind of dickering with it now. Stan is doing just that. All the four albums that we have made are especially made for Sheba. They're a new product. Mm-hmm. And we will continue to make new product and intersperse the old product if, as, and when agreements become available with the companies.
One of your numbers that is an old favorite of mine, and I'm sure a few thousand other people who are listening to it, Pick Yourself Up. And I know you've played that once or twice in your career.
Yes, we have. And when I first, I heard it in my head with a little kind of Baroque introduction, and then a light, jumpy kind of feel to it, and I happened to like it at that time, but it didn't wear very well. Our original arrangement went this way. So it's a nice, light, bright thing, and it wore well as far as the public is concerned. But as far as we're concerned, we got kind of tired of playing it. So several years later, when we were fortunate enough to make a record with Nat Cole, Nat and I were in process of discussion about what tunes we were going to do. And he said, hey, he said, let's do Pick Yourself Up. And I thought, oh, no, not again. You know, I mean, we've been playing it so many times. I said, really, Nat, do you really want to do it? He said, oh, yeah. I said, well, what's your idea on it? How do you think we should do it? And this is what he came up with, and this is why I didn't mind redoing it. This is what Nat came up with on it.
George, you do this sort of thing too well. You've had considerable experience as a disc jockey, and I hope you'll stick to piano playing, or a few of us will be out looking for jobs. And I don't play piano, you know. So
I played piano on my disc jockey show when I had it. See, what I did, actually, I did all this research and found out what key a certain record was in. And one record would end, say, on an A-flat major seventh, and then I would tinkle on an A-flat major seventh, and I'd say, that was a nice arrangement done by so-and-so. And I'd be noodling through E-flat minor 7th, A-flat 7th, D-flat 7th, D minor 7th. But, you know, I'd like to play this one by Count Basie, because to me, Count Basie swings more than, and we're into G7th, anybody. Look out. Here comes Count Basie, and the first chord is C, you know, and this thing is all tied together with the musical interludes, and I did the disc jockey show right from my own home, and so I was able to, you know, stay in my bathrobe while I did it. And of course, I did it interspersed with being on the road, because if you're a disc jockey, you know, unless you're an Arnold Dean, you really don't make enough money to make a, you know, fantastic living out of it.
I'm certainly happy you put that one exclusion in there.
And so what I would do is to make a business out of it. I'd be from 9 until 5, racking up shows ahead of time, and then go on the road for several weeks while they played them, so I didn't have to hear them. And then I'd come back and make some more.
George, if we had time left on the program for you to introduce just one more record, what would it be?
Oh, you spoke about September in the Rain, and since I'll be leaving the studio before it's played, I don't have to listen to it. I mean, we've played it thousands and thousands of times, but maybe some of your listeners want to know exactly what sold 900,000 copies. Well, rightly or wrongly, this is what did.
And that's all the time we have for our visit with George Shearing for tonight. George, I've admired you for such a long time, and it's such a pleasure and an honor for me to be able to sit and visit with you.
Thank you, Arnold. It's been great being with you, and you really, I mean, know the stuff and really conduct a really marvelous interview, and it's a joy to be with you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to have you. Thank you very much. George Shearing.